Today's Teisho will be on Case 5 from the Book of Serenity. Ching Wan and the Price of Rice. Introduction. Siddhartha cut off his flesh to give to his parents, yet is not listed in the legends of filial children. Devadatta pushed over a mountain to crush the Buddha, but did he fear the sound of sudden thunder? Having passed through forests of thorns and cut down the old sandalwood tree, just wait till the year ends. As of old, early spring is still cold. Where is the Buddha's body of reality? Case. A monk asked Jing Wang, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" Jing Wang said, "What is the price of rice in Luling?" Verse. The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign. The family way of the peasants is most pristine, only concerned with village songs and festival drinking. How would they know of the virtues of Shun or the benevolence of Yao? Doing our kinhin, our walking meditation, we could all see what a beautiful day it is out there. Really, it couldn't be more beautiful. This is a perfect time of the year. Not too hot, not too cold. And it's just a wonderful morning. I want to thank you all for coming. Now it's almost perfect. You know, morning like this is almost perfect. For some of you, though, there's one problem, and that's coming up shortly, and that is final exams. Right? So everything would be nice if you didn't have to worry about your final exams. Some of you had to make a bit of a sacrifice to come here today to sit, and I'm really glad you did it. Maybe you could have slept in late and gotten a little more rest, so you know you'd be readier for the coming week and a half or 2 weeks of testing and pressure. And of course, some of you have papers to write, and you know, you came here today anyway, came here this morning anyway, even though you have all those papers to write. And some of you have, you know, a lot to study, a lot of material to cover for your exams. And I certainly know what that feels like. You know, having spent a lot of my time in school, I have caused many students to stay up late at night writing papers, you know. And I have stayed up late at night writing papers myself for, you know, for a long time. So I'm very grateful to everybody for coming here today, even though you have a lot of pressure on you right now. I was really at one time a terrible student, just a terrible student. Especially in math. When I was in the United States, we have what's called middle school or intermediate. There's elementary school and there's high school, and in a lot of places in the United States, you have what's called a middle school or intermediate school. And so usually elementary school is grades 1 through 6, and then 7 through, say, 9 might be intermediate, or some, that's usually how it's done, I think. And then 10th through 12th is the high school proper. For most people, I think when you're in elementary school, the academic demands, at least in the United States, are not very great. You pretty much have to learn how to multiply and count and how to read, and you can get out of middle school. You have to learn how to recite the names of all the presidents of the United States. At least in my school, you did. And it took me about 3 times to pass that one. I remember I was in Mr. Seward's class, his history class, and each of us had to stand up and do all the presidents. I failed it 3 times. I finally got, I think I was always forgetting President Fillmore. I think there was a President Fillmore, and I always forgot his name. But not very strenuous. When I got into middle school, intermediate school, I had to take algebra. I had a very hard time in algebra. As you may know, Americans score very low in international math comparisons. Among Americans, I probably was at the very bottom of that group too. There was something about algebra that just terrified me. I just couldn't, my mind just froze in the presence of these 2x plus 3y equals 10, and I just couldn't wrap my mind around what that meant. And then when we had to work with 2 equations at the same time, that was just horrible. I mean, I just folded. I guessed. I had no idea. I would sit and cry. After I failed the first test, I could still be sort of mildly optimistic. After I failed the next couple of tests, it began to look bleaker and bleaker. Each time I would come in to take the test, I would get more and more nervous. I think that part of what frightened me so much was the prospect of failing, failing the class and failing the test. That the fear of failure was so great for me that it paralyzed my mind. Maybe you're not like this. Maybe this is not the way your mind works. But if I came in, tests are anxiety producing anyway. But when I would think of the possibility of failure, I think I would just crumble inside. I would just collapse inside, and I was just paralyzed. I would be unable to concentrate my mind, focus my attention. And this was my condition in the 8th grade. I had to go through numerous humiliations. The teacher would keep me after class, basically, everybody who failed a lot of these tests had to stay after class and meet with the teacher. And I found that very embarrassing, because basically everybody in my school, or at least in my class, knew why I was staying after class. And I even had to go to the principal and talk to the principal about it. So it was really, really terrifying for me. I really wanted to get out of that class and take geometry. In my intermediate school, there were 2 tracks. You could take algebra 1, geometry, algebra 2, trigonometry, and then calculus, basically. That was what you could take. Basically, there was another track which was for people who couldn't do algebra, basically. It was like geometry, then algebra 1, and it ended up with maybe algebra 2 or something like that. It was a much simpler, easier track. So I really wanted to go on this other track. I did not want to be on the... I mean, because if I couldn't get through algebra, calculus just seemed terrifying, And I had a very kind teacher, even though she kept me after class and it was humiliating. I can't remember her name now. Isn't that strange? This person was so kind to me, And she was such a patient, helpful person. And she made such a difference in my life, and I can't even remember her name. I can still sort of remember her face. But she was so helpful. She didn't frighten me. She didn't humiliate me. And she said, "I'm not going to let you drop this course. You know, I know you can do this." And the interesting thing was, I just kind of gave up at some point. And I just would sit in my room looking at these problems in my math and my algebra book. And after a while, I just thought, this is hopeless, you know. But I kept making an effort, even though I think really did come to believe that it was hopeless. And the interesting thing was, you know, I don't know when it happened, but at some point I figured out how to work with these equations. And nobody in my family could help me, because to tell you the truth, neither of my parents were very good at math either. And I remember asking my father to help me, and he came in and he got stuck on the problems himself and finally just sort of walked out. I don't know how he got out gracefully, but he started cursing and erasing, and then he said, "Well, you'll have to ask your teacher," or something like that. But you know, I just sat there long enough with these things, and I really had given up all hope, you know. And the interesting thing was that I began to figure it out. And I remember, I can still remember this, I swear to you. I went in and took a test. And these were like the most horrible events. I would think about my algebra tests for a week as they were approaching. And they were the most horrible things in the world. And as the day, it would be just like being, you know, I felt the way people must feel when they've been given a death sentence, you know. So it's like as the hour of your execution approaches, you know, the color drains out of your face and you become more and more weak and nervous. And so, you know, I dreaded these tests, but I went in and I took this test, and to my amazement, you know, I was able to answer the questions. And I remember working through the whole test and looking at the clock on the wall and realizing I had like another half hour. So I actually took another piece of paper and I just did every question again a second time, just to make sure I had the right answer. And I turned it into the teacher. And she was such a kind person, she gave me an A for both of them. Right? You know? So my grades up to then were like F, 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 and then AA, right? And after that, I actually got like almost all A's in the second half of that course. And then I went on and I took the advanced geometry, and then I took trig, and I took calculus. And I actually got A's in all of those classes. But I don't know about you, but being at like the zero point, you know, being at the point of absolute no hope, you know, absolute, was actually a very interesting experience for me. It gave me a strange kind of calm and a strange kind of clarity. You know, and it's like, I guess there are people who are supremely self-confident, you know. I haven't met any, but I'm sure there's somebody out there like that. You know, they just sit down, of course I can do it. I guess there are such people, really. You know, they of course I'll be able to do it. But I never had that kind of self-confidence. So when when I encountered obstacles, I just sort of fell apart. I just couldn't deal with obstacles. And you know, strangely, when I was at that zero point, when there was just no hope, you know, nobody likes being there, but you stay there long enough and suddenly you just say, okay, well, let me just fool around with these equations. You know, what can it hurt? I can't sink any lower, right, in my class. I can't get any worse grades than Hamori. And it actually began to pay off. I actually began to figure it out. It's like I had nothing to lose. And this wonderful calm and clear. I did the test twice that day. And after that, it was just, the kind of courage of having nothing to lose, you know, that it was a great feeling, and it's certainly happened to me many times in my life. You know, here at Rutgers University, it's very tough to get tenure. At least it was for me. Again, there are people who come here who are super geniuses, you know, and they already have a book done, and they're doing their next book, and they fly to San Diego, and they fly to L.A., and they fly to D.C., and they fly to New York, and Columbia wants them to speak, and Harvard. Well, that was never me. So, you know, I did a dissertation, which was okay, you know, but when I went out on the job market, you know, I had a hard time getting a job. And I went out 1 year, and I interviewed, and I was flown out to three different universities. And if you're a young professor in there, they're trying to keep, you know, they're considering you for a job, they usually ask you to come and give a paper, some kind of presentation. It's like they want to see your work as a scholar, as a researcher and a scholar. So I, my first year out on the job market, I went to three different places, and I got turned down at all three. You know, so that hurt, right? You know. And I had invested a lot of time in getting a PhD. You know, I was 30 years old when I got my PhD. Is that right? 1984. I was 31 when I got my PhD. And I had started when I was 24, something like that. Maybe, like, that sounds about right. So I'd invested a lot of time and energy in this project, and I went out to and did my best, and no, first university said no, second university said no, third university said no. So I had to do a lot of zazen that summer, you know, like a lot. I'm so grateful that I had zazen to fall back on. Really and truly, I think it would have been extremely difficult otherwise, because it was anyway. And the next year I went out on the market, I really had sort of given up hope, honestly. And I went to a job interview for a technical writing opportunity, technical writing job. And they were considering me for the job when I went to the English professors conference and interviewed with these different universities. So I already thought maybe I wasn't going to be an English professor, I was going to work as a technical writer. And I went to these interviews, which took place that year in Washington, D.C. And I just went in and did the interviews, and I really had no expectation, none, that I was going to be hired. In fact, I thought definitely not. I was back at zero, you know. And the interesting thing was I went to this interview where there were three, with Rutgers University. I didn't know much about Rutgers, but there were three people there, and one was a very mean man, I thought. He later became my friend in the department. Very mean old man. His name was Tom Van Land, and he was the department chair, and he kept asking me all of these tough questions. At the end of the interview, I just thought, well, I struck out, right? And they had asked me for a writing sample, for an article. So I came back to Seattle, and I just went on about my business. I never even sent them the writing sample because I just thought that they had no real interest in me and I'd never get the job anyway. I'd really given up all hope of getting the job, and I got a call from that mean old man, Tom, and he said, "Where's that writing sample?" And I said, "Did you really want it?" And he said, "Well, what did you think, you know?" So I sent it to him, and he offered me the job. It was amazing. And one of the things they said was, "You were so cool during the interview, you know, you were so calm." Well, of course, I didn't think I was going to, you know, I just thought I was going through the, but they said, you know, "You seem so self-confident." And it was like, no, not self-confident, I was hopeless, you know. You know, those are very close, aren't they? Very close. And then here at Rutgers, it's also not only difficult to get here, but it's difficult to stay here. When you after 5.5 years, you have to be assessed for what's called tenure. So you turn in a portfolio of all the stuff you've written, all your class plans and everything, and it's all assessed by a committee of people in your department, and they make a recommendation, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down, right? And then it goes up a chain of command up to the top of the university. And at every stage, somebody can say, no, this person just doesn't belong here at Rutgers, sorry. So, for many people, this is an incredibly nerve-wracking experience. You have to try to publish a book. You need to have a book contract. You want to get those articles into print. All the time that you're going through your early life as a professor, this event is looming in the future, right? It's like the algebra test again, right? It's like the algebra test, only it's big, right? Because in algebra, if you failed algebra, they just put you into elementary geometry, right? Where you could play with a compass and things like that. Which is what I wanted to do. Instead of having to bust my brain with these numbers and these X's and these Y's. But at Rutgers, you know, they don't let you, if you don't get a job here, they don't give you a little compass to play with, you know. You're on the unemployment line, basically. So there's a lot riding on this, right? And now not only had I spent, you know, 8 years or 7 years getting the PhD, but now I'd spent 5.5 years at Rutgers. So that's almost 14 years of my life, right? And so, you know, people can get very tense about this. But you know, I had just given up hope. I really did. I didn't even think about it toward the last part of my 5 years, my 5.5 years. I did a lot of Zazen. I just taught my classes. I was working on a book manuscript, and I just gave up hope. You know, I just gave up hope. And to my amazement, you know, they didn't fire me. It was amazing to me. So that was 15 years ago, something like that. But I think the value of hopelessness is, you know, sounds sort of bleak, right, to say, you know, hopelessness. But I really think there's a kind of value to hopelessness. Now, you know, if I hadn't studied my algebra book, I wouldn't have passed the test. So I'm definitely not saying, you know, just give up, don't study, don't even worry about those exams, you know, go to Rutgers Fest this afternoon. And that's not exactly what I'm saying. But there's a way of approaching problems which doesn't, a way of approaching a problem in which the outcome is really not a concern anymore. See, it's like the outcome is not the issue anymore. It's just engaging with the problem. And I think this is really a superior way to experience so many different things. I hope that makes some sense, but there's a way of just engaging with the problem, and the outcome doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter. And if you can hold on to that spirit, you're probably going to be more thoughtful and creative. You're probably going to be more ready, more prepared to notice something important or notice something. It's just like with koan practice. I mean, koan practice is very similar to this. If you sit on the cushion and you think, oh, I've got to answer this koan. You know, I've got to answer this koan. And as the months go by and you're working with your koan, the more you sit there and think, oh my God, this is the second year I'm working on this, still haven't answered this koan. You get so balled up inside, so tense, so frightened, and you become your own sort of obstacle, right? If you just say, I'll never answer the koan, never answer the koan. So this is a, I think, superior way to experience life. Now, many people don't really understand what koans are or how to approach them, because many things in our culture encourage us to think in terms of outcomes, successful or unsuccessful outcomes. So this little story that I just read is a koan, what we call a koan. This is a subject for meditation in Zen. A monk asked Jingyuan, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" What is the great, and Jingyuan said, "What is the price of rice in Luling?" That doesn't really make much sense, does it? Intellectually. All the same, if you read books on Zen talk to people who have practiced at other places, people understand these as intellectual puzzles or philosophical conundrums. A friend of mine wrote me a letter in which she said that she had gone to a Zen center somewhere else. I won't say what state or where it was, but she said that people actually they discussed the koans like we would have a discussion of a poem. This group really didn't have, in my opinion, a qualified teacher. So they would take a koan and they would all read it, and then they would get together and discuss it intellectually as you would discuss a short story or a poem. And they would try to think it through, So in this case, monk asks teacher, "What's Buddhism all about, right? What's the great meaning of Buddhism?" And the teacher's name is Jingyuan, says, "What's the price of rice in Luling?" Now, you could try to figure it out intellectually. You could say, okay, the price of rice, this is sort of like a practical matter, right? I mean, the price of rice goes up, the price of rice goes down. Maybe he's saying, pay attention to your everyday life. So this is like an intellectual approach to the koan. And this is, this apparently was the way that this Zen group was actually approaching koans in their group. They talk them through. And you might say, well, why don't we do that? Why don't we do that? After all, that approach is used in many different settings. So, I'm an English teacher. When I teach poetry, I come in and I bring a poem. I might bring a poem by, say, Yeats, if I'm teaching a literature class, and everybody will read the Yeats poem, and I'll say, well, what do you think? And somebody will offer his opinion, and somebody will offer her opinion. And after a while, we'll have an interesting discussion. We might disagree, we might agree. As we go on, we gain a better understanding. Why don't we do that? But let me just say, whatever you do when you work with koans, please don't do that with the koan. See, that's actually kind of a big mistake. If you're sitting on the cushion and you're trying to think through your koan intellectually, that's not a good idea. But let me explain why it's not a good idea. If you read a poem, there's a way of reading it, which is probably the one that everybody's going to accept, or many people are going to accept. And there's ways of reading it that most people wouldn't accept. And normally. We would say, this is the best reading of the poem, or this is the right reading of the poem. This is what Yeats really meant. See? Same thing in math, Would somebody like to get the phone? I've done that myself. In fact, I just did it last Sunday morning. Last Sunday morning, we have a sit up in northern New Jersey. I was sitting on the cushion and somebody's phone went off, and I thought, oh, damn it. Those damn phones, you know. And then I realized, oh, my, that's my phone. Really, that actually happened to me. Anyway, the thing is, you know, when you read a poem, there's usually a kind of a right answer and a wrong answer. There's an answer most people would prefer, or say is justified. And there's an answer that most people would say, oh, that's out in left field. And in math, it's the same way, right? 2x plus 3y equals 10, you know, there's an answer we would call the right answer, and there's an answer we would call the wrong answer, right? See, and even in poetry, it's like that a little bit. So, the intellectual approach to life, the intellectual analytical approach to life, produces answers, and their answers are right or the answers are wrong, right? But that's a very limited and artificial way to experience the world. I mean, it's true. 2 plus 2 equals 4, 2 plus 2 equals 5 is wrong, right? Yeats has a poem called The Second Coming, and it's not about Atlantic City, New Jersey, right? There's no two ways about it. But, you know, when we use the discriminating mind, what we're really saying is that this outcome is better than this outcome. This outcome is better than that outcome. And intellectually, that's certainly true. 2 plus 2 equals 4 is better than 2 plus 2 equals 5, intellectually. But there's a deeper way, I think, of experiencing the world. You know, and that's the Zen way, our way. You know, either outcome is equally excellent. See, either outcome is equally Buddha. See, this is Zen truth. So, this may be kind of hard to accept, but in the realm of mathematics, it is definitely so that 2 plus 2 equals 4 and not 5. And it's definitely true in poetry that the Second Coming is not about Atlantic City, New Jersey. That's true. But, you know, there's a certain way in which it's also true, that if I had failed my algebra course and gone into geometry, after all, nothing would have been lost in my life. Now, you know, my story has a happy ending, so-called, right? Because I did pass the test, I got better, and this is the truth. I did. You can ask my mother. I got through that course with an A. I did figure out algebra. I did get an A in algebra 1. I did get an A in algebra 2, etc. Got it. But you know what? If I hadn't gotten that A, you know, nothing would have been lost from my life. This is the reality that Zen is concerned with, right? So, you know, we don't think that way. We often think in the discriminating way. This answer is preferable, and also this outcome is preferable. But there's another sense in which that's just not so. It's just not so. In our ordinary way of thinking, we do believe that there's a right and a wrong answer all the time, and there's a good and a bad all the time, good and bad outcome. And we are terrified of the bad outcome, of the wrong answer. In math, there is such a thing as a wrong answer. And even in poetry, there's something like a wrong answer. But in life, in a certain way, there is no such thing as a wrong answer. And this is why we don't use the intellect to answer our koans. Because the intellect only just says, this is right and this is wrong. This is the good answer, this is the... But there's a certain way in which every answer is the right answer. See, every answer, this is a... You know, I might have talked about this before, but, I met my wife while I was cooking in an Italian restaurant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She was a student, an art student, at the University of New Mexico, and I was traveling in the Southwest doing backpacking, and I was working in this restaurant to make money. And I liked the person who was going to become my wife. My wife's name is Barbara. Barbara, I liked her, you know. We had some fascinating conversations. And I really liked her. And once I even locked her in the walk-in refrigerator. She went in there to get some, you know, grated cheese or something, and I locked her in, and she had to knock on the door, and I let her out. And you can see I was an idiot. But I was trying to say, I like you, you know, I like you. So I didn't really have too many social graces, I guess. But I was flirting. And we had, we had coffee, and when the restaurant was over with, we all used to go upstairs and watch Star Trek in the bar. After the end of a long day in the restaurant, you know, they would show reruns of Star Trek, and we would all compete to say which episode this was. You know, if you got 1 minute in and you didn't know, oh, this is the episode with the Tribbles, or this is the episode, you know, this is the episode in which Spock has to go back to Vulcan and so on and get married, you know, we would compete to see how quickly we could, because we all seen them thousands of times. And I would talk with my wife and the woman who became my wife, and we had a good friendship, you know. And then I was preparing to leave because I had made an arrangement with my friends to meet them in the Pecos wilderness. I resigned, turned in my 2 weeks' notice on the job. And I was preparing to leave. It was like my last night. And I was coming out of the kitchen, and I saw my wife, the woman who became my wife, sitting there. And I said, you know, I'm leaving, but do you want to just go out and get a drink somewhere and just chat? And she said, at first she said, no, I don't think so. I think she felt sorry for me. She said, oh, okay, you know. So anyway, we went out and had a drink, and we talked, and we really hit it off. It was like really interesting, you know. And then I said, well, listen, can I write you? I'm going to be on the road, but could I write you? And she said, sure, you know. So I started writing. We carried on a correspondence. And as a result of that correspondence, I actually came back to Albuquerque later, and we eventually got married and so on, you know. Now, you know, it's when we look at life, you might say, well, what if I hadn't come out of the kitchen at that moment? See, what if I'd spilled some spaghetti sauce, you know, and I had been cleaning up the spaghetti sauce, and then I'd come out, my wife had already left. You know, my whole life would be different. And, there's a part of us that wants to say, you know, if I hadn't come out there right then, you know, my whole life would be impoverished, right? And indeed, I've been married for 30 years to this person, and I hope we are together for another 30 years. But the thing is, you know, it's absolutely not true. In my opinion, you know, if life could have taken another turn, and it wouldn't have been worse than the life I've lived. You know, I could have gone to that interview at Rutgers and not have gotten the job. They could have said, well, you're a nice guy, but you're just not Rutgers material. You know, you're just not what we're looking for. And, you know, you could say, oh, I would never have come to Rutgers. Oh, it's just, you know, my life would have been so impossible. Not so. You know, that's the discriminating mind, right? See, the discriminating mind looks at choice A and choice B and says, which will I take? So, which will I take? And it says, if I take B, then, I'll take B, not A. You know, you pick B and you think, oh, thank God I didn't take A. So that would have been a bad alternative. If I had taken that one, my life would have been impoverished. That's the discriminating mind. That's the small mind. But, you know, you sit on the cushion, and you sit on the cushion, and you sit on the cushion, and you watch your breath, or you call move. You work with your koan, and your little mind tries to figure this stuff out, you know. And it will be A or B, A or B, A or B. And at some point, you know, you're in the pure presence of existence. And you realize every moment is the pure presence of existence. Whether I can choose A or I can choose B. Now, you know, the thing is, if you choose A, there's going to be problems, right? If you choose B, there's going to be problems. It's an illusion to imagine, you know, well, this is the one with no problems. But problems too, you know, that's an interesting issue, problems. Because problems too are a kind of illusion, right? You know, problems too are a kind of illusion. You know, I have a friend of mine who's been married 3 times. And this person told me recently he's carrying on internet correspondence with somebody, and he says, this time I think it's the real thing. Now this guy, he's my friend, but I just feel like crying, right? Because it's like, every one of these has been the real thing, you know. It's like, well, but with my wife number one, you know, she just didn't like bowling, and I like bowling, you know. It's like, great, you know. Wife two, what was the problem with two? You know, well, this was, you know, well, there's going to be a relationship with no problems. It's like, ah, well, please write me when you find that, right? But problems are not what we think they are either. Like choices are not what we think they are. The problems are not what they think they are either. I love the problems I've had in my marriage with my wife, because they've constantly forced me to be a bigger person, you know, a better person. You know, when people get married, they marry the image they have of the other person. And then you go through this relationship and you realize this person is not what I imagined. This is what we call sort of a problem, right? And at that point we can say, well, get out. You know, you're not what I imagined. Goodbye. You know? But sometimes what we realize is you're not what I imagined, but this is kind of interesting. You know, this is like a road I never saw. You know, this is like something that I wouldn't have imagined, but it's very interesting, very wonderful to be here with you having this problem, right? So, when I first got married, I was like a politics addict, right? You know, I would read the New York Times every day, and get steamed about something, you know. And it used to bother me that my wife was so quote-unquote apolitical, right? I thought, oh, she's not, you know, paying attention to the world. She's not, you know, she's running away, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, little by little, I began to realize that, you know, she had a point, you know, a wonderful point. You know, I haven't really made much of a difference to the political life of my society. You know what I mean? A lot of it's just been an argument going on in my head. And, you know, I began to do things like go out in the garden and work with my wife planting flowers, you know, and not worry so much about the president. And you know, began to think, you know, this is pretty damn good. You know, this is a beautiful way to live. And, you know, if you're not so angry and upset sometimes, you can be kinder to people all the way around, you know. So, you know, I realized, you know, my wife taught me something about limits of being a political animal, you know. This has happened to me again and again, you know. So problems aren't what we think either if we don't approach them in terms of like right and wrong, yes and no. Everything is like a door opening up for us. Now the thing is, you know, you choose this door, behind door A is what? Buddha. Behind door B is what? Buddha. Interesting. And so that's a beautiful thing about life, you know. And you can say, well, I don't want that Buddha. I want the other Buddha. You know? Well, that's your koan, isn't it? You know, that's your koan, right? You know, if I had not gotten my job at Rutgers, that would have been the Buddha I didn't want, right? But you can't solve that problem with the discriminating intellect, because the intellect just wants to choose yes, no, right, wrong. But there's a way in which everything is Buddha. Behind door A, Buddha. Behind door B, Buddha. This is the Zen path. This is the Zen path. There's a way in which everything is already perfect. Right? Now, 2 plus 2 plus, mathematically, 2 plus 2 equals 5 is not perfect, right? But actually, getting the question wrong is perfect. It's what has to be right now. And there's a way when we sit on the cushion and we enter deep mushin that our problems just dissolve in front of us. And we're in the pure presence of existence. And this is the way of Zen. This is our path. Right? Every choice is a kind of a false choice. Because every door is in the same direction. It's the same outcome. A monk asked Jingyuan, what is the great meaning of Buddhism? Jingyuan said, what is the price of gas in New Jersey? Right? What's the price of gas in New Jersey? It doesn't quite work, but that's sort of what he's getting at, right? You think, oh my God, the price of gas, it's gone through the ceiling. You know, I'll be able to drive us. It's the end of Western civilization. You know what? The end of Western civilization is also Buddha. Actually, that's true. So that's actually true. You know, last time I did the Taisho, 2 weeks ago, a couple of people came in. And they just wanted to sit in on the Taisho. And I was basically giving a rather heavy talk, I thought. Sort of, you know, you give these Taishos, I don't have any plan. You just follow where it goes and you just hope people come back next time, you know. And it took me in an unexpected direction. And I said, eternal life doesn't exist, you know. This was the day before Easter, of course. See, and I wasn't trying to step on anybody's toes. What I was trying to say is, look, you know, if you're afraid don't be afraid of death. You know, don't be afraid of anything. You know, to put it another way, it's like this. You know. I can say, don't worry about death, just cling to the idea of eternal life, but that probably doesn't solve the problem. If you're not afraid of death, you don't need eternal life. Right? Another way to put it would be like this, and this is maybe in Christian tradition, you know, when Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb of Jesus, the body is gone. And so that's understood to mean, you know, God is real, and our salvation is assured, and that's a wonderful truth. That's absolutely true. Okay. But also, if Mary Magdalene had gone to the tomb and the dead body was there, you know, that is God too. So body could be resurrected and body could not be resurrected, but God's there, always there. Either outcome is your salvation. Yeah, either outcome. So you know, every door is Buddha. Every door is Buddha. Every door is Buddha. This is what I meant, not necessarily what I said. So there's a little bit more to this koan, and then I'll stop. What's the great meaning of Buddhism? Jing Guan said, what's the price of rice? See, actually, what's the price of gas won't quite work because, see, I mean, rice is so cheap, right? Rice is just the cheapest thing. It's everywhere. It's the basis of, you know, a meal is rice, but you don't talk about the rice, you talk about what you put on the rice. Rice is the thing everyone takes for granted. It's always there. It's the you could say it's the ground of our being. It's the ground we stand on. And see, this is always here. Rice is always here. Every problem is your rice. And you say, I don't want to eat that rice, but nourishing you in every atom of your being. So every problem is your rice. What is Buddha? It's rice. There was a teacher who said, you know, all you have to do in this world is lean down and eat. It's always good food. It's always pure food. This is not true intellectually, right? If you get a 100 on your exam, wonderful. You know, and I hope you do. If you get a 50 on your exam, it's going to be hard to explain to your parents, right? But in a, please study, please do your best, but 100 on the exam is Buddha. And honestly, 50 on the exam is also Buddha. Also Buddha. So then the question is, you know, then it's a different kind of test, isn't it? It's a different kind of test. So then it's about how you live your life. It's not about the outcome. It's about how you live your life. Because the outcome is assured. It's like no matter what hand you get dealt, it's actually a winning hand, even if you lose the game. So then the question is, am I playing the game I want to play? And am I playing it in the way I want to play? And you should be. You should be playing the game you want to play, and you should be playing it the way you play. And if you're playing the game you want to play, and you're playing it the way you want to play it, who cares? You know, who cares whether you get 100 or 50? You're living from the deepest part of yourself. Yeah? That's our life. That's the Zen life.